where they that sustained several rockets and missiles. Did we see how much the children suffered, the cold weather and winter? Why the international community allowed the people to survive that long? And now we are saying that Israel is going to be improving this. People on the ground, they don't trust that Israel is going to improve the situation at all. I don't see this is going to be changing unless there is more international pressure on Israel to allow construction materials into the Gaza Strip. The UN mechanism is unfortunately failing to deliver what is needed to the Palestinians in Gaza because the UN is simply not able to convince the state of Israel of the importance of rebuilding the Gaza. When Palestinians having no homes and there is no hope, what do you expect?
Mohammed Omer, we only have a minute to go, and I wanted to ask you about the Islamic State issuing a warning to Hamas that they're going to take over Gaza. How real is this?
This is non-real. It's not going to happen because I believe, and many people believe, that Hamas is much stronger on the ground than the Islamic State. Those people who have issued this, I have talked to Hamas officials, and they informed me that those people have a psycho distress, and they are people who do not know what they are talking about. They're just a bunch of people who are not necessarily able to translate what they have said on the ground. I believe Hamas is much stronger on the ground, that the Islamic State cannot turn Gaza into Al Yarmouk, as the Islamic State said. That's one. And I believe also that the environment in Gaza does not allow an Islamic State like groups to spread in the Gaza Strip. People don't want this type of mentality in the Gaza Strip. We have seen that across the Gaza Strip. People who are supporting the Islamic State, they have received resistance from people and from the Palestinian police in the Gaza Strip. So this is something which I doubt is going to be happening anytime soon.
We have
the
to
Gazans
leave it there.
Are still continuing.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Award-winning Palestinian journalist reporting in Gaza City, his book Shell Shocked, On the Ground Under Israel's Gaza Assault, has just been published. He tweets at the handle Mo Gaza. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Martin Yermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our guest host, Doug McVeigh. Today's guest is Haven Wheelock, Syringe Exchange Program Coordinator with Outside In, who provide much-needed social and health services to the houseless and disenfranchised.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street from 5 to 9 p.m. The community parade will start at 10:45 a.m. There will also be artisan, craft, and community booths, sidewalk sales, live music, food, and more. Again, that's the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 to 5 p.m. with an after party on Clinton Street going until 9. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School Series, Portland's Urban Native Americans. What you need to know to be an ally. Classes will start July 8th and continuing for 4 weeks on Wednesdays at 7 at Southeast Uplift in Portland. Classes will focus on issues such as federal policy toward Native peoples, inequities Portland's Native peoples face, blood quantum, and more. It will also address contemporary ideas of privilege, white fragility, and the complexities of intersectionality. Again, that's Portland's Urban Native Americans. What you need to know to be an ally. Wednesdays at 7 p.m. at Southeast Uplift, 3534 Southeast Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high? If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. It is 8:05 a.m. You're listening to KBOO in Portland. I'm Doug McVeigh, sitting in this morning for our regular host, Paul Rowland. Our guest today is Haven Wheelock. She's the Syringe Exchange Program Coordinator for Outside In. They're a local nonprofit whose mission is to help homeless youth and other marginalized people move towards improved health and self-sufficiency. We're going to be talking today about harm reduction, about syringe exchange, and overdose prevention, and a lot of other services, all having to do with helping people who happen to use drugs and people who inject drugs. Haven, good morning.
Good morning.
Syringe exchange programs are nothing new. We've had them out here in the Northwest. In fact, as I recall, the first syringe exchange programs in the United States were out here in the Northwest back in the 80s?
Yeah. Outside In started its program in 1989. We're the third oldest legal syringe exchange program. They were happening underground before that. We were the first publicly funded syringe exchange being funded by Multnomah County. So that started in 89.
In fact, Multnomah County is, that's one of the other things about Portland. It's got one of the longest running public support for the for syringe exchange and that kind of harm reduction service. The feds have a ban on funding using their money, but state and local money can be used. Are syringes still available through pharmacies without prescription, or has that changed?
In Oregon, yes, they are.
In Oregon, right on. Yeah, it's all state by state.
Exactly. There's no mandates nationally on that.
And, of course, there are some folks out there, well, you're just making it easier for people to use drugs. And the other side of that is that, no, people can use drugs. What we're doing is keeping them from hurting themselves and hurting others from the drug use. Tell us about the work that you're doing in your program.
The syringe exchange is pretty wonderful. I'll speak just to Outside In, although we do work very closely with Multnomah County Health Department, which also has their own syringe exchange program. We're seeing, this year we saw 4,500 unique clients through our space, a wide range of people and ages. State law requires you to be over the age of 18 to access clean syringes, so our clients range anywhere from 18 to 84, I think, is our oldest client currently. The vast majority, over half, are under between 18 and 35. Primarily, they're heroin injectors. However, about a third are injecting methamphetamines and or other drugs. So,
right on. And by the way, folks, of course, this is a call-in show as well as talk. The phone number, if you want to have a, if you have a question, if you have a comment, is 503-231-8187. And this is the. I've done work in criminal justice and drug policy, public health for a number of years, but I've always been on the policy side, you know, and debate's fun, but then actually service, you know, providing services, you know, making the contact with people, doing that direct service outreach. I've always had tremendous admiration for people who do that because, I mean, that's That's frontline stuff. Mm-hmm. That's really where it's, I mean, you know, we sit back and we talk about it and then afterward go out for coffee or a beer with the people that we've been debating against. And that's, I don't know, it's fun, as I say, but there's, but it's just doing that. It's just doing that talk and politics thing, whereas the people at the front line actually doing the service provision. Well, yeah, my hat's off to you. This is it's great work that you're doing. Wow, we actually have a caller already. All right, hello, James. Do you have a question or a comment? And good morning.
Well, I guess I was expecting a little more talking to happen before I got on the line, but. No, as far as like drugs and houselessness, I don't know. I've been talking to people about it. You know, like Portugal, like I want to say it was like the early part of the 21st century. They just stopped criminalizing drug use. You know, they legalized drugs and they started treating drug use as a medical problem, not a moral problem. And I feel like that's the biggest issue that our country is facing, is that we still seem to hold on to these ideas that people who use drugs are inherently bad people, or that there's something wrong with them, and they dehumanize them in many ways. So it relieves them of any responsibility that they may actually have in order to help people to better themselves.
You know, James, I think you've got it absolutely right. I mean, one of the biggest problems is criminalization. What Portugal did about a decade ago was to fully decriminalize to the extent, I mean, people can still be brought in front of a commission if they're found to be using drugs problematically, and they could end up being referred to treatment. If they're not using problematically, if they're simply using marijuana and they got caught out in public, they might get a little bit of a "you're naughty" and told to be a little more careful. But that's the thing. We talk about stigma as a barrier to things like treatment, and yet we don't think about the biggest stigma, which is criminalization. I mean, if you face the risk of losing your family and being put in jail or possibly prison just because you say you've got a problem, well, that's going to stop people from coming forward and saying they've got a problem.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about how, you know, but I think that's one of the things, you know, I don't know what the latest statistics are on drug use, but I mean, I would imagine that it'd be, you know, if people are feeling that stigmatized about coming forward about the problems they have, it might seem like drug use is down, but really it's just people being silent because they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to have everything taken away from them simply because they have a problem. And, I mean, more importantly, I mean, I feel like if we're going to criminalize drug use, then we ought to include alcohol, you know? I mean, people talk about marijuana being a gateway drug, but, I mean, the biggest gateway drug is alcohol. You know, people want to feel good, they want to have a good time, but you, like, nobody criminalizes alcohol. I mean, you see billboards for it everywhere. It's, you know, drink this, drink that, be sexy, be fun, be amazing, you know, drink our beer. You know, I mean, I don't know, I would imagine that if you know, people just need to wake up that, you know, if drug use isn't, I don't know, I mean, just really just treating, you know, the problem of addiction and people, you know, I don't know, I guess I feel like people just are less happy these days, even though we seem to have more and greater access to things, stuff. It's like we're really missing a lot of very human things, like real interpersonal connection and, you know, real community, basically. So people just turn to lots of different things to fill those needs that we should be working together as a community to make sure everybody has them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I mean, I gotta ask, Haven. A lot of programs. One of the benefits to the syringe exchange programs has been the direct outreach, talking to and, you know, basically you're gaining the trust of the people who are coming in, and that's where people are actually getting tested for HIV. They're getting tested for hepatitis C. In fact, most of the testing for a while there that anybody was doing in general public for hepatitis C was syringe exchange programs. People are also getting advice on basically healthy lifestyle and, among other things, referrals to treatment. Do you folks do referrals to substitution treatment out here, or is that
every single day? Every single day. I think, you know, speaking of stigma, I think that we as a culture are really quick to judge drug users. I don't know how often I hear about someone getting their bicycle stolen with a follow-up comment that, like, darn meth users stealing all the bicycles, which is not necessarily true. There's no evidence that being on meth makes you steal things. And I think that that stigma really plays into how people connect with healthcare. It's, it plays into their, even beyond the criminalization piece, which is clearly there. You see people being afraid to go to the hospital when they're sick because they're afraid of how they're treated by their healthcare professionals. And one of the huge benefits to syringe exchange is it is a safe place for people. We've worked really hard over the last 25 years to build trust in this community and have this community trust us. And so one of my major jobs is to spend time humanizing people who they themselves don't feel human. They are so used to being ignored. I have this wonderful story of a client who got hit in the head with a 2x4, and she came in bloody, and I helped her get her face cleaned. I got her a new shirt since she was like covered in blood. And the next day she was surprised to find out that I remembered who she was. She just felt that invisible that she assumed I would have forgotten something that to me was incredibly tragic and awful. And yet in her mind, she was that level of invisible. And I think we need to be really mindful as people operating in the world that we're not perpetuating those stigmas. When we say things like, you know, blaming drug users for the ills of our community, you're really further pushing that stigma forward. And so I like to like bring up how stigma is bigger than just criminalization, because even if you decriminalize drugs, there will still be stigma. In like, it'll help, but it's not going to make it go away until we as a community acknowledge that these are people we care about and care about in our community. And I don't think I answered your question.
Well, no, actually, very much so. And James, thank you so much, because that was a really important point. The whole thing about, you know, people feeling separate, feeling alone, and it's not just a question of, it is, in fact, sometimes just a question of not having access to things like, recreational activities and libraries and the other kinds of things. When I was growing up in Iowa, those were things that we took, we just took for granted, and they're not really always there for folks. And then as we get older, it's very easy to just sort of be in your shell. Mm-hmm. And the more marginalized you feel, the worse it gets. Mm-hmm. And just that human contact, the people who acknowledge your humanity, is so very important. It's just so very important. Better remind people who they're listening to. Hi, I'm Doug McVeigh. I'm sitting in today for Paul Rowland, your regular host. This is Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO-FM in Portland, Oregon. Our guest today, Haven Wheelock, Syringe Exchange Program Coordinator for Outside In. We're talking harm reduction, we're talking syringe exchange, treatment, and in that kind of stuff. The number to call is 503-231-8187. And I've got another caller on the line. Hello, Joanne. How are you doing today?
Yes, hello. I'm having neck and shoulder pain. It may be hard for me to get my words out. But anyway, I'll do the best I can. This criminalization, it's not funny. And after listening about Eric Holder, the ex-attorney general, I don't think anything honest is going to be done about criminalizing us in this country, but I hope they make me wrong. But in the meantime, I have a question. I don't know if the woman can answer it. Older adults, I know there's enough problems in the world for young people and they need help, but can low-income older adults get help at outside in with chiropractic or counseling or support groups? And I'll get off the air and let you answer.
Thanks, Joanne.
Yeah, so Outside In's medical services are not limited to just youth. So our medical clinic will see anyone, regardless of age or housing status.
You know, and that's neck and back pain. One of the biggest issues we have had in this country, for the longest time, we ignored pain as a condition. If you suffered from pain, you were thought of as a wimp. Ah, just suck it up. Ah, it's no big deal. Ah, you can just deal with it. And, well, no, really. And sometimes it's not enough to just destroy your kidneys by taking aspirin and continuing to take aspirin all day. That's one of the reasons why we had an expansion of pain treatment, where people understood that you really do have to deal with the problem. And the easy way to do it, the cheapest way to do it, is to just hand a few pills off to somebody and then give them more pills until they stop bothering you. And then after a while, the doctor realizes, whoops, they've been handing them too many pills. And so they start cutting back, and that starts the person to crave more because they can't get them from the doctor. They maybe start going out to the streets. And well, in fact, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, just yesterday released new data showing that heroin use within the United States has increased dramatically over the last decade. The numbers are all tricky. As our friend earlier was pointing out, stigma sometimes keeps people from admitting use. And really, the numbers are so small that in these surveys, just a little bit of a difference can look really huge. On the other hand, the DEA reports that heroin purity has increased, that the price has dropped, and they say that there are more and more, there's more and more coming in, they're seizing more and more. So all the indicators are that, yes, we are seeing more of that in here. And then going back to pain, we find that in treatment, a lot of the people who are in methadone treatment, sizable number, are pain patients. Mm-hmm. And it's not just they started that way. They continue to be pain patients. In a sense, they're treating their pain with the methadone that is treating their addiction. Do you find a lot of folks who are suffering from these other co-occurring conditions, and especially pain?
Are you asking if we're seeing people using heroin to treat their pain?
Yeah.
Yes. The answer to that is yes. About 45% of the clients, really in line with what the CDC put out yesterday, report to us that they started on prescription drugs before they were using heroin. So that's of our heroin using population. So it is really common, and we are seeing an increase in the number of people using syringe exchange. It's been pretty steady over time, going up. This year we exchanged almost 900,000 syringes in the syringe exchange, which is almost double what we were exchanging five or six years ago. So we are seeing more of that. And I definitely have conversations with clients regularly who would like to stop using heroin, but are really concerned about what they're going to do about their pain and how to mitigate that. And many of them will go on to like a methadone program, which will help with pain. Suboxone can also help with pain. So, yeah.
Right on. Well, let's get to another caller. I have Francis on the line. Hello, Francis. How are you doing today?
Hi. I agree with everything you said about the criminalization of drug use. And in those recent statistics, I think that just in Portland alone, the deaths from overdose of heroin have increased also because of the purity of the substance that's coming in, which I understand a lot of it is coming in from Afghanistan. What I wanted to speak about, though, is that Outside In, I cannot say enough about Outside In. It's probably one of the most valuable and worthwhile resources for our community here in Portland.
Thank you so much for that.
I was a student at Portland State probably about 45 years ago and became ill with strep throat, and I didn't have medical insurance. I went to Outside In and was helped immediately. And that was 45 years ago when it was in a house on the mm-hmm. corner up off on 13th. And now, recently, I went with a man in his 60s, a loved one who recently got out of prison, had no resources whatsoever, has diabetes, and needed to get some insulin. And he was helped immediately with syringes and the insulin that he needed. And when he lost his insulin because he's homeless and went back up there, they gave him some more. I am totally impressed with the services that Outside In provides to our community, and there should be more, not less. But I just want to give a plug to Outside In. I think it's one of the best resources we have in Portland.
I do too.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That is so sweet. That is so sweet. It's good to and it's good to remember this. It's not just the syringe exchange program. You provide a whole lot of services. Of course, we're talking largely about that because that is what you do, mm-hmm. and overdose prevention, another thing which you work on, the naloxone distribution. For those who aren't aware, naloxone is an amazing drug that can actually reverse an opiate overdose, not just help out, but stop the overdose. Practically speaking, brings people back to life. It's becoming more widely available. In fact, the state just expanded availability. Am I remembering that right? What happened?
So, actually, we're coming up on our two-year anniversary of starting our naloxone distribution program in 2013. The state legislature made it possible for lay responders, so people who aren't medical providers have had it and carried it on ambulances for 45 plus years. But the state of Oregon passed in 2013 legislation that allowed lay people to start having naloxone, carrying it, using it on people when they suspect an overdose. I am proud to say that Outside In was the day the rules became into effect, began distributing naloxone to drug users in our community. We have trained over 1,100 drug users primarily. We also have trained some family members of people who are using drugs, some professionals, but most everyone, like 93% of people we've trained, have been drug users themselves and clients of the syringe exchange. And we've had over 700 overdoses reported back to us having been reversed. Wow. In that two-year period. So
wow.
It's exciting stuff.
It is amazing. And of course, it's not just heroin in most cases that's causing the overdose, that's causing the harm. I mean, more than half of overdoses nationally, heroin overdoses, involve other drugs. A lot mm-hmm. of times they're benzodiazepines, sometimes it's alcohol, and sometimes the heroin itself isn't just heroin. There are other things. Nowadays, fentanyl has been mixed in quite a bit, mm-hmm. and that's in some places responsible for a lot of the overdoses that we're seeing. And that's tremendous. Okay, let's bring in another caller. Before we do, real quick, the number, of course, is 503-231-8187. And Alan, you on the phone there?
Hi. I want to say first that I agree with decriminalization. That allow people to come forward. I agree with that man. My feeling is that our country has a big problem, and it's, well, the mood that we have just socially. When you talk about the Supreme Court and its conservativeness, and our congressional mood also being so conservative, and also the fact that we have all our prisons are for profit. I want you to talk about the obstacles that you feel that are preventing you from running a better program just because of what's happening in this country and how, you know, we seem to be prudish about the things that we want to keep the way they are. So maybe talk about that. I'll hang up.
Thanks. All right. Well, now what kind of, I know that there are some things that your program can't do. In this country, there are some things that we just... In Canada, there's a thing called Insight in Vancouver, BC, which is what's called a supervised consumption facility. It's actually a supervised injection facility. There are trained nurses on staff. There are substance abuse counselors on staff. Certainly, it is a needle exchange, but it's also a place where people can go in and use. There is a large area where they are able to, in relative privacy, inject. If there's an overdose, it gets immediately reversed. There have been no deaths reported out of Insight. They do a lot of treatment referrals. They do a lot of counseling. I visited there a few years ago when they were just putting in short-term residential treatment, well, basically residences up in that building. And that's in Canada. There's a thing called, it was originally the North American Opiate Medication Initiative, or NAOMI. That ended and has become a thing called Salome, which I, for the life of me, can't remember what it stands for. But essentially, it's heroin maintenance, prescription heroin, much as we have methadone in this country, and we have now buprenorphine also available, which physicians can prescribe to people. In Canada and in several nations in the European Union, they actually have prescription diacetylmorphine, which is essentially heroin. And what they find is that people will come in, they'll do it, it's not really a big deal. It's viewed as a thing that some people do if they have to. The glamour goes away. Kids don't really get into it, and the addict population ages out. It's a thing that we can't do in this country. In fact, they wanted to. They proposed the idea back in the Bush administration. Our then drug czar, John Walters, absolutely refused. He was completely opposed. Back in the Bush administration, you could not even say the words harm reduction, dating all the way back to the Reagan administration. You could not use the phrase harm reduction. And I mean literally, in a grant proposal, in a research paper, if you tried to, you could forget about being published, you could forget about being funded. In the last few years, in the Obama administration, we've actually had officials using that word harm reduction. Back in 2012, the Harm Reduction Coalition had its international conference here in Portland. The then drug czar, Gil Kerlikowske, sent a videotaped message, which was... I mean, it was amazing. It was just totally amazing. Then last year in Baltimore,
yep.
You know, you were there.
I was there. It's true.
And so you actually got a chance to see our current drug czar, Michael Botticelli, physically in person addressing the Harm Reduction Coalition conference. And not just addressing it, he had meetings with people. He was there talking to folks like my guest.
I shook his hand on the sidewalk in front of the conference.
And that's, it's amazing to think how far we have come. Of course, that's a factor of having our current administration. Who knows what'll happen in the next administration. But back to our caller's question, what kind of barriers do you see? Is the federal funding ban a barrier for you?
So I think there's a lot of different things that, you know, what you're talking about, these big picture things like heroin clinics, like safe injection facilities, those kind of things are a further step out than where we're at. But there's a lot of things that structurally we can be thinking about today in terms of helping people. One, housing first model housing, the more vulnerability-based housing that doesn't require someone to be clean and sober can really help people move forward. And while we have a couple vulnerability-based housing programs in Portland, that's something we really need to be looking at, because like housing people, you can't get healthier if you are not housed. You can. It's just a lot harder for people to take those steps to be healthier when they're sleeping outside. The federal funding ban is a big issue. Portland, our syringe exchanges have been solidly funded through the county health department for many, many years now. But I think especially in outlying areas, there are many parts of our state where you cannot get syringes for free. And often pharmacies will give you a hard time getting them. So, you know, access the federal funding ban and allowing communities to decide whether or not to use monies for these programs would be very helpful. Access to treatment. You know, there are many treatment programs that insurances don't cover. They put a lot of stipulations on who can get what kind of treatment, what kind of treatments are covered, what kind of treatments aren't. I think that those are all things that, and actually having enough beds for people to go to. I talk to people every day wanting to go into detox, and there's often a week's wait, a 2 weeks wait, a 3 weeks wait, even for a bed for detox. And that doesn't necessarily guarantee them that they will be able to get into a treatment program, even with if their insurance does cover it, in a time frame that is realistic for them.
In some localities, the local government uses zoning to prevent people from putting in a methadone clinic. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they're stuck in places that are the seedier parts of town, mm-hmm. and you know, warehouse districts and awful places. The way that we, the federal government, methadone is highly restricted, and very tightly controlled. The whole notion of take home doses, no. Show up every single morning at this place at 6 o'clock in the morning and wait in line and get your dose, and then you can go off and try and go through the rest of your day. And really, good luck maintaining a job and a regular life when you're stuck in that kind of weird role. I participated in some, well, I helped with the research on a project for take home dosage of methadone, mm-hmm. A few years ago in Lancaster County. And we actually found great success. Among other things, we had a physician working with us, and the people in the program were able to get direct help from the physician and more counseling than they were getting from the clinic that they were attending. We're seeing some great results out of that. And now, of course, we have buprenorphine, which people can get from their physician. And with the physician, you can address other kinds of issues that might be there, the underlying problems or the other things that were...
One of the things about buprenorphine is, yes, primary care doctors can't, you have to have a special license in order to prescribe buprenorphine. You can only have 100 patients at any given time if you are prescribing buprenorphine. And it's a huge barrier that doctors face because you have to have the license, and then you have to have space for these patients. And in our community, I would say that while Suboxone and buprenorphine are available in our community, once again, it's another situation where access is not quite up to where it should be.
Right on. So again, some of those institutional barriers, and we've made some progress. I know the feds have, and they allowed buprenorphine treatment in the first place, and then they've started to make it a little easier, expand the number of patients. But yeah, it's still quite limited. Before we go further, I should possibly mention, since we're talking about drugs and things like that, of course, we don't encourage or condone the use of any kind of drug, legal or illegal. I'll admit to using coffee. That is my drug of choice. But I try to keep it under control. And I note that caffeine can actually be quite dangerous. People can go to the hospital for a caffeine overdose. Heck, there is, in fact, a toxic level. For that matter, alcohol. There are thousands of alcohol overdoses in the United States. There are as many alcohol overdose deaths in the state of Oregon as there are opiate overdose deaths. And when you talk about drugs in combination, the same thing applies. Alcohol in combination with opiates can be a deadly mix. They're both central nervous system depressants. And the reverse, if you're on prescription medication and taking alcohol, well, if you're using alcohol and you happen to get some pain pills, things can happen. And that's the important thing about naloxone. If you have a relative or a loved one or a housemate or a friend who is on a pain prescription, and so you know that they are using an opiate legally, but say they still want to have a beer occasionally, mm-hmm. they're at higher risk for overdose. Now, you're doing trainings for lay people with naloxone. Would that, would a loved one and such, or does it have to be the person who's actually got the prescription who'd be able to get the naloxone?
So lay people can carry naloxone. So our program is specifically funded for our clients at the Syringe Exchange. I do trainings for anyone who is using opiates, whether they're prescription or not, although I will admit that the vast majority of people that are coming to me for trainings are using heroin. But if someone came to me and was like, I am using OxyContin and I would like some naloxone, I'm not going to turn them away for that. We do some trainings for parents and loved ones, but because our funding is very much tied to training drug users, we try and keep that our focus as much as we can. There is this thing called co-prescribing of naloxone, however. If you have a prescription for opiates, in many places, in a couple different pain clinics here in Oregon, you can actually get a prescription from your doctor if your doctor is willing to write it. And I would encourage anyone who has a prescription for opiates to talk to their doctor about their risks for overdose, because doctors are often hesitant to talk to you about it. And there's a lot of different reasons why doctors are hesitant to talk about it, as well as patients are hesitant to ask about it. But when you have opiates in your house, people are at risk for overdose. And so I encourage everyone, and I actually talk to my doctor about it every time I see him, even without an opiate prescription, just to kind of nudge the medical community to thinking this is normal. But like really having those conversations with your doctor and like asking if they are willing to co-prescribe naloxone for you anytime that you have an opiate in your house can really help keep people safe in case something does accidentally happen. If you know, your risk for overdose changes depending on how your breathing is. So if you have a lung infection, that standard normal dose of your medicine that you've been taking can actually lead to respiratory depression and potentially death. So being really mindful that it isn't just people who are misusing opiates that are dying from opiate overdose. It's not just people who are using these drugs recreationally. It's really anytime you get a new medication, you're at a higher risk for overdose. Anytime you're changing meds, anytime you're not feeling as well, those kind of things all can play into your risk for overdose.
And we'd like to think that physicians would be careful and get it straight, but these things don't always happen.
Well, and I think it's a new thing, too, for doctors to be able, like, to know that they can co-prescribe these medications is the other thing. Like, it's not the fault of the doctor to know that this is something that we're moving in that direction. This is something we should be doing. Those are new concepts for doctors in our community. So, you know, the more we can encourage that, the better.
Indeed. Well, and things like the prescription drug monitoring programs, mm-hmm. possibly you're seeing a psychiatrist who's giving you a particular medication, that you're also seeing a physician to talk about another condition. They're both prescribing, and maybe you forgot to mention, or you didn't think that you needed to mention the antidepressants you're getting from the one because the person's giving the opiates. Well, we've got another caller. Before we get there, I should let you know that you are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO. Well, you probably already knew that. I'm Doug McVeigh. I'm your guest host this morning, sitting in for our regular host, Paul Rowland. Our guest today is Haven Wheelock. She's a Syringe Exchange Program Coordinator for Outside In. Actually, you've got a very long title, which I'll ask you to say in a second. But Outside In is a local nonprofit which does a lot of really great work with a lot of people. And here's a few things before we get to our next caller. The phone number, of course, is 503-231-8187. I have to take care of a little housekeeping and station business. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, host Roberta Hall speaks with Mary Christina Wood, the faculty director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center at the University of Oregon School of Law, about her book Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And again, our guest is Haven Wheelock. Tell me your title again, Haven, because you got halfway through and I just couldn't remember it.
I have a really, really long title. I am the Injection Drug Users Health Services Program Coordinator. Typically, people shorten that to the Syringe Exchange Coordinator.
Well, there you go. And let's see, we have a caller. Do you have a comment or, Karen?
Hi. Thanks for all of your good work at Outside In. That last question was actually my main question, but a couple other little ones is I know that a lot of needle exchanges around the country are actually starting to do wound clinics, so I don't want to be inappreciative of what you all do, but I wonder if that's a direction you're also able to move into. And then I also wonder about getting the word out about bad batches of heroin and how that tends to happen, and if there are other ways besides the word of mouth that it can happen more quickly, or places to check in on kind of the increase of overdoses when there is bad heroin out there. Thank you.
Thanks.
So we don't do a wound care clinic in the Syringe Exchange, but our Syringe Exchange is less than a half a block away from our primary care medical clinic. So all of our wound care and like skin care referrals, all of the clients of the Syringe Exchange can be clients of our medical clinic. So if someone came in presenting with a wound or a skin infection, we would refer them to our medical clinic. And we do about 300 to 400 referrals to our primary care clinic a year. So we just, you know, if someone's in dire situations, we'll walk over there with them. If not, we'll send them over on their own. And anyone who, whether they're insured, uninsured, regardless of age, housing status, can all be seen by our medical team. And I would say that having that available 5 days a week would be better than what I could do in-house in our Syringe Exchange if I could only have a doctor there once a week or once a month. I actually, anytime we're open, have access to a full team of medical providers who are much better at dealing with that than I would be. I am a community health worker, not a medical provider. So that is that. And there are more and more wound care clinics coming online, but we're not doing one in our actual Syringe Exchange currently. And then your other question was about notification when bad drugs are on the streets. And I love our community so much, and it's so wonderful to be part of a community that actually really has gathered together around harm reduction. We work really closely with Multnomah County Health Department in terms of their Syringe Exchange program. If we start seeing an increase in overdose reports, if we start hearing from people about people being sick from drugs, I contact the health department. The health department contacts AMR, which is our ambulance service. We all kind of have a connected network on getting that information out. Law enforcement is involved. If they see an increase in calls for overdose, they'll contact us to ask what's going on and help get the word out. We've had a couple different situations where we've been able to like pretty brilliantly put out mass scale notifications on bad drugs that are going through, and it's been really effective so far.
Excellent. It's taking care of the community and humanizing and treating people like people. Of course, bad batches, too strong a batch. People don't understand why people would be drawn to a batch that's, oh, this is super strength. And that's, it can be a little scary. But it's good that you're doing that you have the primary care clinic so close. Mm-hmm. That's a factor of the trust that's built up with the exchange. People don't necessarily want to go to the doctor. They're afraid of what could happen. There's a thing called sudden brief intervention and referral to treatment, mm-hmm. which is a federal program. Doctors in emergency rooms and clinics around the country get money for referring people into treatment. And when you're talking about being referred into the system, that's a scary concept for people because they're thinking system as in a system that wears a badge. And we've got a lot of money for drug courts these days. If you get arrested, then you can be, if you're lucky and you're thought of as a, if you're evaluated and regarded as a good bet on treatment success, if they think that you're going to make their statistics look good, then you can get a referral into treatment. And of course, if they don't think you're a good prospect for treatment, then you just get locked up and thrown in a hole and forgotten about. And, you know, it's really sad. I do a lot of research on drugs and crime and public health and the like. And we started these drug courts back in the Clinton administration in a massive way. Actually, the first one was done by Janet Reno in Florida when she was the state attorney general. And it just exploded through the 90s. And if you look at the progression, the increase of drug courts, and then you look at the explosion in the number of drug arrests, in particular possession arrests, they almost go in lockstep. The easier it got for police to arrest and then just move people through the system, the more people they arrested and put into the system. The idea was to try and release the pressure, but somehow what happened was we just decided to keep the pressure just about the same. Now, in Seattle, they have a new program where the police are actually doing what they call a pre-arrest diversion. A weird name for things. Basically, they're telling police it's okay to refer these people on the streets and the people they encounter, drug users and such, to treatment and to social services, and they don't have to arrest them. In fact, it's more like don't arrest them. Give them the help they need instead. Mm-hmm. Do you see any possibility of Portland doing that kind of thing?
I am a Pollyanna who believes that there's all kinds of hope for all kinds of things. And the LEAP program is a wonderful, wonderful program. And they actually were just, some representatives from that program were just in D.C. talking about that program last week, I think. I would love to see more of that moving in more of that direction. And I think that that's another one of those things that if we can't move to decriminalization of drugs, this is one way we can kind of address this in a harm reduction approach.
Right on. LEAD, of course, law enforcement assisted diversion. And yeah, brilliant stuff. Okay, we do have another caller. And Barry?
Yeah. Barry. Hello, thank you for taking my call. One of the negative stigmas of the needle exchange program, even though it's not your fault, is all the needles most Portlanders run into, these abandoned needles on the sidewalk and the street in the parks. In fact, it made the news about a month ago because there was one area under, I think it was the Hawthorne Bridge, was just littered with these syringes. And I know it's not your fault that these syringes are, how much do syringes cost in the drugstore, and is there any program of cleaning this up? The area they showed probably needed a 55-gallon drum to carry them all away.
You know, that's a good point. The whole how do you dispose of? I mean, they're hazardous waste. They're mm-hmm. they're medical. You know, they're medical waste, and that's true for, well, whether you're a drug user or whether it's an insulin needle or mm-hmm. if you're. When I was in 12 years ago when I was in chemotherapy, I had to give myself a subcutaneous injection of a white blood cell enhancer. And so I had this collection of used things I had to take back. That's a real pain to try and do. Do you folks do that kind of collection and disposal?
So I should start by saying we have a 99% return rate on our syringes. So for all the needles that we hand out, we typically get back between 100. We've had years that we've taken back more than 100% of what we've handed out. This year, we're at 99%. So pretty much all of the needles we give out come back to us through our exchange, and we dispose of needles that way. There's a lot of barriers to people getting rid of their syringes. People are very afraid to carry dirty syringes with them because they can get arrested for those. So people are prone to disposing of them that way. It's Portland Metro will take hazardous waste, but like very few pharmacies will take back syringes. Hospitals don't want to take back syringes because the actual disposal of syringes is one of our highest costs, actually, for our program.
See, and that's something that you would think a pharmacy or a hospital should be doing. Because again, it's not only the drug users who are using syringes for something that's illegal. You've got people using syringes for their insulin. Mm-hmm. You've got the cancer patients who may have to inject themselves with a red blood cell enhancer or a white blood cell enhancer. And there are other reasons why people have these. And yeah, it's a... I remember back in Pennsylvania, we finally got some of the local pharmacies to put a red box out so that people could safely dispose of them. But, you know, what do you do otherwise? Put them in an old coffee can and throw them into the trash? Well, you know, your garbage collectors are going to be rather upset when those things come falling out. Needle stick injuries are a constant threat. But if you're getting a 99 or more return rate, you're doing and he's quite right. That kind of cleanup is a very necessary service. While we still have time, and I got to remember, if folks want to call in, the phone number here is 503-231-8187. If you have a question or comment, want to find out more from Haven Wheelock about her program, and Outside In, where do people find out information about Outside In? I was just on your website, but what is that URL?
Outsidein.org.
That's an easy one to remember.
pretty straightforward there.
Now, where is your program located, and is your syringe exchange, do you do a mobile thing, or is it just there? I think Multnomah County does a mobile, doesn't it? Or?
Yes, so Outside In has two fixed locations, actually. We do syringe exchange on Main Street, right near our medical facility. And then we also are the only syringe exchange site in Clackamas County. So we do syringe exchange out in Clackamas County one day a week at the Clackamas Service Center.
Fantastic. As a resident of Clackamas County, I'm glad to know that.
Yep.
That's excellent. And let's see. Okay, we don't have any callers, so let's just keep talking about some of this stuff. Now, Outside In's been around, the syringe exchange program, since 88. How long have you been coordinating that?
I have been with Outside In's syringe exchange program for, it'll be 9 years this year. So I'm coming up on my 9th anniversary of working in the syringe exchange. I've been coordinating the program for about 4.
Very nice. Yeah. Very good.
One thing I would like to bring up before we end is that the state of Oregon just passed a Good Samaritan law for the state around drugs. So that law will go into effect January 1st. I'm very excited. I worked really hard. Michelle Williamson was one of the representatives that helped sponsor this bill. And I and many others worked to get this bill passed. And it's exciting that it passed this legislative session. And this law will make it so you can't be arrested for drug possession, probation parole violations, or for drug paraphernalia if the reason you're talking to law enforcement is because you yourself overdosed or because you were the person who called 911 for someone who was overdosing. I think it's a really important harm reduction based step that we're taking in our community. And these laws only work if people know about them. So since I'm on the radio, I'm going to mention it.
I'm glad you brought that up and reminded, because you'd mentioned that before. And that is a really important. Some of the groups I've worked with in the past, Students for Sensible Drug Policy mm-hmm. has been doing a lot of work around Good Samaritan 911 laws on college campuses. Of course, I mean, alcohol overdose, the same thing. When you're a 19-year-old and the person who you're hanging out with takes that shot of Everclear punch, except it was mostly Everclear and not much punch, and all of a sudden they're not breathing. So what do you do? Do you wait until they've died and then take them someplace? Do you just sort of kick them out into the street and hope someone finds them? Or do you take them to the hospital or call 911 and take the consequences? And a lot of people are scared of right. those consequences. But so now the Good Samaritan bill, actually, does it cover alcohol overdose as well, or does it only cover illegal drugs?
So the bill that we just passed was focused on illegal drugs. However, last year, not this legislative session that just ended, but the one before, passed an alcohol Good Samaritan law for our state. So that happened in 2014 that we passed a law.
Fantastic. So we do have, so people can, if they're experiencing an overdose, if someone they're with is experiencing an overdose, you can contact law enforcement, you can call emergency services. Usually one shows up with the other, but you don't have to fear being put in jail just because you've tried to save your friend's life. That's right. You'd think that's such a no-brainer. You'd think that would have been the rule anyway, but of course, it's not. It's not. And you're right, public education. The only way people know these services available is if they hear about it, which is why we're here. Well, this has been Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. I've been sitting in for Paul Rowland, your regular host. My guest today was Haven Wheelock. She's Syringe Exchange Program Coordinator. I'm not going to use that longer title. With a group called Outside In. They're a local nonprofit. They do harm reduction and good. They do a lot of really good work here. You should check them out on the web. I want to thank you so much for listening. And let's hear some of that Charlie Parker.
Is proud to present The Harder They Come as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Harder They Come is a 1972 Jamaican crime film. With dreams of becoming a successful reggae singer, a young Jamaican man, played by Jimmy Cliff, finds corruption from his record producers and the drug pushers they're connected to. Again, that's The Harder They Come, Thursday, July the 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. So as sure as the sun.